You can't make this art by yourself, right? An actor is only as good as the playwright who's written the play, as the director who's put the show up, as the lighting designer who's put a light on you so that the audience can see you. It's only as good as the people at the box office selling tickets for the show to, like, in order to pay for all of this art to happen. It's only as good as the ushers who bring you to your seat and make sure that the audience has a good experience. It's only as good as the person whose sole job is to come in after the show is done and sweep the stage clean at night so that you have a clean stage the next day. I mean, there is a job for everyone in the theater. If you feel like you are somebody that doesn't have a sense of belonging, come to the theater. The theater is the place where there is a job for you. And what a beautiful sort of microcosm of what I would love the world to be.
Welcome to the Connected Leadership Podcast, hosted by Andy LaPata, the show where Andy and his guests explore the many ways in which relationships impact business decisions, make leaders' jobs easier, and help you to progress your career.
Hello, and welcome to the Connected Leadership Podcast. I'm Andy LaPata. Thank you very much for joining me. I'm really excited about this conversation to come up. It's someone that I met in London very recently, about 2-3 months ago, when he was on a flying visitor over here. I first came across him recently when he turned up as someone who's endorsed our new book, The Financial Times Guide to Mentoring. And when I saw that, I thought, this is someone I actually would really like to meet. And we had a really lovely coffee in London, and we're going to catch up again when he's here in April. But in the meantime, I wanted to get him onto the Connected Leadership Podcast. Who am I so excited about talking to, you ask? Well, you should have read the show notes. He is a Broadway performer. He's a recording artist, a producer, and a theatre arts teacher. He played Aladdin on Broadway. He played Wes, one of the Dalton Academy warblers in Glee. He's appeared with George Takei and Leah Salonga, and he's been directed by Neil Patrick Harris and Billy Porter. All in all, a pretty good CV, but it gets even better. He's recorded 2 solo albums. He's appeared in many Broadway cast recordings, and he's an adjunct professor at New York University's Tisch School of the Arts. Sorry, I stumbled as I said Tisch School of the Arts because it just sounds like someone hitting a cymbal on a drum. And I really like that for a performing arts school. So from the Tisch School of the Arts and Broadway and everywhere else, including your televisions, Telly Leung, welcome to the Connected Leadership Podcast. Thank you for joining me.
Hello, how are you, Andy? It's so good to see you and speak to you today. I'm actually not coming to you from New York University. I'm actually here at the University of Michigan today, where I'm guest directing a production. So I'm actually coming to you from Ann Arbor, Michigan, where I'm here for the next few weeks working with the students.
Fantastic. And what are you directing them in?
I am directing a Stephen Sondheim musical called A Little Night Music. It's often done at opera companies and universities because it's got a nice large cast. And of course, you know, we get to dig in and dive in on some Sondheim, you know, who I consider sort of the Shakespeare of musical theater. So we're having a really good time putting the show together. And I think the students are learning a lot. So I'm thrilled to be here.
Wonderful. Well, Sondheim is an absolute joy. And I know I've got a couple of friends who are huge musical theater fans. And yeah, they would be with you, I'm pretty sure, in terms of how they see Stephen Sondheim. You know, I've laid out an impressive CV, and that's not even touching the sides of it. We haven't even talked about the Netflix series you're starring in at the moment. But what I'd like to do is understand a little bit about your upbringing and how you got into the arts and your experience in the arts. And always, as always, keep a little bit of a lens, keep a bit of an idea on the connections that you've made in your career, the importance of relationships to you, and what we can take from your story and your journey and apply in other areas of work and life. But let's start with your upbringing. You grew up in a traditional Chinese home in Brooklyn. And obviously, there are certain stereotypes of different cultures and different ethnicities and what families expect of their children and the aspirations that they set. How true to life were those stereotypes of a Chinese family for you, and how supportive were your family of your ambitions to work in performing arts?
Well, I always believe that stereotypes are to some degree also based on a little bit of truth. And I have to say that when it comes to sort of the tiger mom stereotype of like what it is to be an immigrant parent, sacrificing so much to come to this country to then try to give their child a better life, I think my mom and dad sort of fit the tiger parent stereotype pretty closely. But, you know, you also have to understand their experience, right? Like they grew up in communist China during the Cultural Revolution. And, you know, this was, of course, a time of great political and economic upheaval in China. It was also a time where Mao was re-educating the youth. They were sort of de-educating from Western ideals and ideals of capitalism and sort of refocusing the next generation on communist ideas. And I think my parents, growing up in southern China, they grew up in Guangzhou, they realized that without an education and without a worldly exposure to experiences around the world, that they weren't going to get very far. So actually, my parents, when they were teenagers, escaped communism, and they're a part of a generation of teenagers called freedom swimmers. They grew up in southern China in Guangzhou, and they actually escaped communism by swimming to Hong Kong, which at the time was a British Commonwealth. So this was like the late 60s, you know. And, you know, my parents actually didn't meet each other in Guangzhou. They only met when they both arrived in Hong Kong. And my mom, you know, swam. That's the 7-hour swim, snuck out in the middle of the night to try to get to Hong Kong with several friends that wanted to escape with her and make the swim. She tells me, you know, that it was late at night. And when they jumped in the water, she's never heard or seen from those friends ever since that night. And, you know, she made it to the other side after 7 hours of waiting in the water. My dad actually tried swimming the first time and was caught by the communists. And he surrendered because they had guns pointed at the water. And so when he surrendered, they sent him to a re-education camp in rural China to do manual labor. And unfortunately, the communists failed at re-educating him, because when he was done with his punishment, he came back to his home in Guangzhou and he tried again. And he made it the second time to Hong Kong. And he actually changed his name to Loi Sang, which actually means born again in Chinese. So, you know, for them, that was the beginning of their journey to then come to America. Because when they met each other in 1975, they started dating, they started finding out all the things that they had in common with one another. And I think one of those things was that they realized they wanted to get married and have a child, but they also wanted that child to grow up in a place where they had all of the opportunities that they did not. So they didn't have very much money. I think they had $200 in their pockets, and they flew to the United States, and they were looking for places to settle because they wanted their future child to be American. They looked at Seattle, and, you know, Seattle, a wonderful Asian population there. They felt like it would be a really great place to transition from Chinese life to Hong Kong life to American life, but not a lot of work in the 70s in Seattle. Then they went to Hawaii, again, a huge Asian population. They had many friends in Hawaii, many friends in Seattle, but then again, not a lot of work in Hawaii. And then when they realized, well, we have one friend in New York, and there's plenty of work for immigrants in the 70s in New York City. And so they crashed with a friend in an apartment on Mott Street. They had $200 in their pockets. They crashed on a friend's couch. My mom and my dad started working in very common jobs for immigrant parents in the 70s in Chinatown in New York City. My mom worked in garment factories, and my dad worked in Chinese restaurants. And eventually, you know, over the course of 30, 40 years of working in New York, like, my mom went from being somebody who didn't know how to sew to then, like, working her way up the stations in a garment factory, taking herself to night school to learn pattern making and fashion design. And eventually, by the time she retired, you know, she was on the short list with every major designer in New York City. She worked for Anne Klein, Ellen Tracy, Isaac Mizrahi, Badgley Mischka. You know, she ended up retiring working for The Row, which is the fashion line for the Olsen twins. You know, so she really is the epitome of the American dream. And my dad is the same story. He went from being, you know, an immigrant dishwasher in a Chinese restaurant to eventually becoming a waiter, becoming a manager, for a little while owning his own restaurant, which was very difficult and was a business that failed quickly, and retired managing somebody else's restaurant, you know. So all of that hard work, they had one kid, me. I was an only Chinese son. And, you know, I think for them, A, they couldn't afford to have another child with blue-collar jobs in New York City, but B, they were like, oh, great. We have a Chinese son. He's going to carry on the last name. He's going to marry a nice Chinese girl and give us lots of Chinese babies and, you know, probably become a doctor or lawyer or an engineer or something. And none of that happened. None of the above actually happened. So I think they had very high expectations for me. I think, of course, they wanted me to do well in school and go to Harvard and become all of those things that they could not become as immigrants, you know, a doctor, lawyer, engineer. And I think for them, that meant achieving a level of financial success that they could not achieve as immigrants coming here in the 70s. And it took them a long time for them to sort of support my path as an artist. And, you know, I always say that I had two coming out processes, that I came out to them first as an actor. And I said, Mom and Dad, I have something to tell you. I'm not going to go to Harvard and become a doctor. And I'm going to try a life in the arts and become an actor. And then I had my actual second coming out, which actually, because I came out the first time as an actor and I was like, well, I've already disappointed them once, my tiger parents, that I'm going to go into show business. You know, I probably will disappoint them again by telling them that I'm probably not going to marry a nice Chinese girl and give them, you know, Chinese babies, grandchildren in that sense, you know. So I think in some ways it is based, some of those stereotypes are based on a little bit of truth, because that story, I know it is not uncommon and it is not, you know, just me that has that story. But then again, I think it's important to understand where that story comes from. And for them, it started all the way back when they grew up in China and they wanted to seek more opportunities and want more opportunities for their children. And who doesn't understand that, right? Like that is, I think, the truth that's underneath that stereotype, that here are just two people who have a child and want the best for their child.
It's a really interesting glimpse into their backstory. I was thinking to myself, with everything else you're doing, can you fit in writing your parents' biographies as well into that? Because there's a hell of a story there. I want to come back briefly to their journey in terms of supporting you and how that impacted you, as well as how that background played into what you do now, because I'm sure it's had an influence. But it just struck me, there was so much there that fascinates me. But particularly that choice of turning down two or three locations to settle in where there were supportive communities of people they knew, and choosing the one where they knew one person because of the prospects, the future prospects that that offered. That's a really understandable, but must have been a very tough choice. Do you know to what role the Chinese community who didn't know them played in supporting them and lifting them up, how alienated they were at the beginning, what that experience was like for them?
I think, of course, it's an alienating experience when, you know, go to the other side of the world, go to a place where you've been speaking Chinese your whole life. And my parents, actually, they would like work their jobs during the day and then they would go to night school to study English, you know? And they also, by the way, they learned English by listening to a lot of popular American music in the 70s, and they also watched a lot of television. That's actually how I got my name, Telly, because I'm named after an actor in the 70s named Telly Savalas on a show called Kojak. And my mom loved Kojak. And when it came time for her, you know, she had my Chinese name picked out, but she said, well, this kid's going to grow up in America and he needs an American name. She just went, I like the name Telly. That sounds like a common American name to give my Chinese child. And it ended up being pretty unique name, because I often get asked, you know, is Telly a stage name? And I said, no, that's my name. That's the name that my mother picked for me because she loved Kojak so much.
There you go. She loves her baby.
Yeah. And I think part of that is the Chinatown communities sprung up in an effort for Chinese people to support each other, right? Like, I think that's very true of New York Chinatown, San Francisco Chinatown, certainly London Chinatown. You know, there is power in numbers, right? And there is a sense of safety when you sort of all gather together. That I think I took for granted a little bit. And then when COVID happened and there was all of these hate crimes aimed towards our elderly Asian populations, I went, oh, right, this is why Chinatowns exist. They're not just wonderful places for you to go and get dim sum when you feel like it on a Sunday morning. They formed and they existed because this community needed each other. Whether they knew each other or not, they were all in the same boat now, halfway across the world, trying to build a better life for their families. How do we do that in a society where systemically it is not built for you to do that? Well, we gather together, we try to help each other, and we form these communities together. And I think that is really how Chinatowns sprung up all over the world.
Well, let me pick up on that, because your career now, it's in a community, the arts community as well. And it's a community that I can imagine can be both very supportive and very understanding, but also highly competitive, particularly when you're all going for the same role. Do you see similarities between people from one ethnicity coming together to live close together, to lift each other up, and the way the artistic community supports each other, or are they very distinct and very different dynamics in each?
I think there are certainly similarities in that there is a sense of all human beings instinctively, and that there's a primal want to feel a sense of belonging, right? And for ethnically specific communities like a Chinatown, I think that there are just cultural traditional things that bind us together, that in a place as foreign as, you know, the United States, for somebody who's just coming here from China, all the way on the other side of the world, that there is a little bit of home, a little bit of familiarity by coming together and sharing language, traditions, all of that, right? So I think there's a sense of that. I think with the theater community, I think we're all looking for the same sense of belonging, right? And I know that when I started doing theater, I was a high school student. I actually did end up going to a math and science high school in New York City called Stuyvesant because, again, I wanted to make my parents proud. So I hit the books hard, I studied hard, and I was certainly on the path to go to Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and Brown and be a doctor, an engineer, or something. But, you know, what I ended up doing was in that math and science school, I found I didn't quite feel like I belonged. I was very good at academics, but it wasn't what I loved. Do you know what I mean? Like, and I was surrounded by people who loved biology. They loved chemistry. They loved physics. And now, many years later, they're now doctors and surgeons and astrophysicists and chemists, right? Biochemists. Like, and I realized, gosh, I'm in this place and I don't really belong. You know where I do belong? Going to my rehearsal after school for my high school musical, which I'm actually not even graded on, and it's an extracurricular activity. That's where I feel a sense of belonging and a sense that there's a place for me. And that is, at the end of the day, why I love theater, because to me, theater and putting on a show is a microcosm of the world I want to see. There is a job for everyone. This piece of art does not exist without the coming together of people to make this art. You can't make this art by yourself, right? An actor is only as good as the playwright who's written the play, as the director who's put the show up, as the lighting designer who's put a light on you so that the audience can see you. It's only as good as the people at the box office selling tickets for the show to, like, in order to pay for all of this art to happen. It's only as good as the ushers who bring you to your seat and make sure that the audience has a good experience. It's only as good as the person whose sole job is to come in after the show is done and sweep the stage clean at night so that you have a clean stage the next day. I mean, there is a job for everyone in the theater. You don't have to sing, dance, and act and be on stage. In fact, there are so many other jobs behind the scenes that are vital to the creation of this art. And if you feel like you are somebody that doesn't have a sense of belonging, come to the theater. The theater is the place where there is a job for you. And what a beautiful sort of microcosm of what I would love the world to be, that there is some place in the world for everyone. You may think you're a misfit. You may think you don't belong. You may think you're an outsider. And yet in the theater, what it is that you bring to the table, if you're willing to bring it, is valued.
That's absolutely beautiful. I think we could repurpose that as an ad for recruitment for the performing arts sector. Absolutely wonderful. There's a couple of things I want to pick up sort of going back following this thread, which I promised to do. So when you discovered the performing arts and you discovered your passion, and I really like the fact that you said other people love the sciences, other people really got that, well, you didn't have the passion for it. And I'm a great believer that you have to be passionate about what you do if it's at all possible, because you're going to spend most of your life doing it, let's face it. So once you found that passion, were there any obstacles in your way because of your background, because of your cultural ethnicity and history? Or were there advantages to it? Were there disadvantages? How did it play out for you? Or was it the same experience for you as anyone else?
I mean, there are tons of advantages. You know, again, now that you sort of know my parents' story, you know, to them, the American dream is a monetary dream. You know, in China, in communist China, where they grew up, there was no way for them to, like, work hard, save money, and have those things that they wanted. You know, and for my parents, they dreamed of, well, we would like to save enough money to have our own house, you know, save enough money to have our own car, to put three meals on the table and put our kid through college. You know, that was like that was their dream. And I think for them, having me, they were like, well, certainly my son's dreams will be the same, right? Well, they will look exactly like my dreams. And actually, what I think what ended up happening was, you know, I then all of a sudden came out to my parents and said, hey, mom and dad, by the way, I have other dreams that don't look like the dreams you have for me. I know that you dream for me to be a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer, and get an Ivy League degree, but I think you don't dream that for my happiness. You dream that because you think that that will lead to some sense of financial security, which is the thing that you came all the way over to the United States to achieve. Well, guess what? I think I'm the other half of that dream, which is that you've had me in this country and now I have choice, you know? And I always said to them, of course, they voiced their fear right? As any parent would, that here they are, their only son going into the arts. Will he be a starving artist? Will he ever find work? And they have every reason to think that. It's not like growing up in the 70s and 80s and 90s that there were a ton of Asian faces on TV for them to go, well, look at all the Asian people working in show business. That still today, there's not, you know, if we're going to look at the numbers, like it's not like we're always seen on television. Do you know what I mean? So, you know, it was such a big deal that Michelle Yeoh won an Oscar, you know, and like, I can't wait for the day that it's not a big deal for people, for someone like Michelle Yeoh to win an Oscar. I can't wait for that day. But right now it is a big deal, and it's because we don't see it often, right? And that, this is 2024. So again, my parents had every reason to sort of not be supportive or to push me in a different direction that went against what it is that I was passionate about. I think part of what I needed to do with my parents was to convince them, hey, mom and dad, you did raise a really smart kid, and I know exactly what I'm doing. I know what it is that I am sacrificing, and I know what it is that I am giving up, which is financial stability, in order to go into this profession where I am doing something that might not give me that kind of stability, but I am aware of the cost and I'm making the decision anyway, because there are some things about the American dream that I cannot put a price tag on, and I cannot put a price tag on how I want to spend my life. And for me, it's about spending my life in the theater. Again, I will tell you to this day, you know, sometimes it makes no sense for me to be in this business. It makes no common sense. When you look at the numbers and you look at the sort of the percentages of how many actors are actually working at any given time, it actually makes no sense to any person that like has any sort of business sense. And yet we do it. So why do we do it? Like, why? You know, there has to be something that does make sense that doesn't have dollar signs on it or pound signs on it. There has to be, right? And I think once I sort of told my parents that, and I think they were aware that I wasn't just going into this blindly, purely out of passion, that my head and my heart connected to that decision, I think they were like, well, then go with God. We can't really stop you then, because you're right. You are making a very educated decision. You know that the odds are against you, and yet you still want to do it. What can we do? And I think slowly but surely, they are supportive. Now, listen, they are still tiger parents. So, you know, I've done 7 Broadway shows, and many of those shows were not hits. So they opened and closed after 3 or 4 months. And every time a Broadway show would open and close, they go, okay, Telly, are you done? Your dream done? Playtime over? You go to grad school now? Like, I think they were always hoping that, like, you know, I would finish a Broadway show, go, okay, he did it, and he's going to get out of show business. And it really wasn't until my 7th Broadway show at 39 years old, when I played Aladdin in Disney's Aladdin on Broadway, that they stopped asking if I was going to go to grad school and get a real job after the Broadway show ended. You know, so it's very, I think for now, they're sort of like, okay, we fine. He's going to do what he does. And also, I think after that, you know, from 19 to 39, you know, I went to college when I was 19 years old. At 39 years old, when they stopped asking, that's 20 years of a track record where I was all right, you know, and I was able to do what it is that I love to do and achieve all of those things that they thought of as the American dream, right? I too have a house. I too can put 3 meals on the table. I too can support myself doing what it is that I love. And I think they saw that over the last 20 years and they went, oh, right, that's the other part of the dream that we couldn't have because we were just trying to get enough money in the bank to like feed our kid.
I'm sure they're really proud of you now.
I think, yes, eventually they were, always been proud. I think, you know, with being proud of your kid also comes worry, right? Yeah. As soon as I realized that their worry and their lack of support for me going into show business was something that was out of love and concern, I stopped resenting them. You know, I stopped sort of going, well, why can't mom and dad support what it is that I do? And I have all of these friends who, you know, grew up going to ballet class and tap class. And, you know, my parents never exposed me to that. And I eventually just realized, oh, right, that's not the world they came from. Chinatown is in the southern tip of Manhattan. The theater district is in Midtown in Manhattan. You know, I don't think my parents realized that there was like a whole other like world of Broadway just 20 blocks north of Chinatown. Manhattan was Chinatown to us. And I grew up in Brooklyn. So we took the train to Chinatown. We never really went north of that. You know what I mean? There was no reason to. And here I was sort of expanding my view of what the city, all the possibilities of what the city could be. And I've sort of branched out and found arts in the city. And so, yeah, I just had to realize that that wasn't I think they gave me as much as they could. And it was sort of up to me to find the rest.
Enhance your mentoring skills with the Financial Times Guide to Mentoring by Andy Lapata and Dr. Ruth Gotian. Secure your copy early by pre-ordering today on Amazon or your preferred bookseller.
Well, let's focus in on that rest then. So as you've progressed over that time in a successful film and theatre career, which have been the connections that you've made that have been the most important to you, and how have you relied on other people? You talk so eloquently about everyone involved in a production, and you listed a lot, but there's still many people you haven't even mentioned in that list.
Absolutely.
So which are the most important relationships you've built, and how have they helped you on that journey?
Well, I can honestly say this, that I've now been doing this for over 2 decades. And if I really look back on every wonderful opportunity I've had in this business, I can honestly say that they have all come from me meeting someone on a previous project or a previous production. And yes, I am oftentimes still, as an actor, actors never stop auditioning. I still go in and I still audition and I still meet new people and new collaborators. But you better believe that if I'm auditioning for a director that I've never met, that they look up and down my CV and they go, what other director have they worked for? I'm going to pick up the phone and I'm going to call and ask about telly, right? Or, oh, you've worked with so-and-so. That's my friend. Let me call and ask about that person. And I have been told many times that part of the reason why I do get to work so frequently is because when they pick up the phone and they ask about me and they check on my references, that people go, absolutely, you would be very lucky to have telly in the room, you know, for this particular project. That's often what's said. And I'm very proud of that. And I honestly do think I have to credit my high school theater director. His name is Vinny Grosso, Mr. Grosso. He's no longer with us. He, at the math and science school, he taught mechanical drafting, CAD, and engineering. And he would volunteer his time after school to direct the high school musicals. And again, simply because he loved it. And he realized he wanted to create a space for all of the kids that didn't feel like they belonged, right? To find them a space where after school, they could feel like they could come. You could sing, you could dance. If you didn't do that, you can come and paint a set. And you could feel like you were working on something with a community of people. Mr. Grosso was the person that said that to me. Said, you know, Telly, in the theater, there is not one person that is more important than someone else. So you may be the star of the show with your name and lights above the title. You are no more or less important than the person whose job it is to sweep the stage every night. And that is their sole job, because everybody has an important, vital function in the theater. And I've approached every single performance and every project with that mentality on day one of rehearsal or day one of a shoot. I truly try to bring that energy, whether I'm the star of the show or not, or directing the show or not, and really trying to give each person their due respect for their job and their function in the theater. And that has served me very well. That has served me very well because it's made for a happy working environment for me. It has made for really good relationships and a sense of mutual respect for everyone working on the project. That goodwill is something that you remember when a project is over. And I know for a fact that because that is something I try very hard to do, take the spirit of what Mr. Grosso told me when I was 14 years old, that I still hold with me, to give everybody their due respect in a project. I know that that is the reason why people pick up the phone and call me over and over again for projects. I know that because at the end of the day, who knows if a project is ever going to be a hit? When you do this long enough, you go, listen, we're just going to make something together. We're going to put the art out there. Maybe this show will be a Broadway hit. Maybe this TV show will run for season after season, but you never know. You actually never know what's going to hit it. So in not knowing that, why don't we make the process of it as pleasant as possible? It's already so difficult. This business of making art, show business. It's already so hard to even get in the room and get on stage and get on a set. Once you're there, let's just make it the best environment possible to make art, right? And then worry about whether it's a hit later. Do you know what I mean? I think so much of it, of us worrying about this has to be the best Broadway show ever, this has to be a hit, or this has to be the TV show that everybody watches and you know, and run season after season, and I have to make this money or I have to get this award doing the show. I think that pollutes the actual art making. And one, because you're so result oriented, we're no longer process oriented. And we're no longer sharing that experience with the people that we are making the art with. And I think that is vital. Again, theater, it's not, or TV, filmmaking, not something you can do by yourself, right? Like, it's not that art. It's not that kind of art. If you wanted to just make art by yourself, you could be a sculptor, you know, lock yourself in a room with a big piece of rock and come out with the David one day. But like, that's not theater. It is a group effort. It's a communal art. So I think that has always been the lesson that has served me well. And every job that I have, including this one right now that I'm directing a musical here at University of Michigan because the person who was the head of this program, a wonderful gentleman named Michael McElroy, I worked with on Rent on Broadway. And because I met him on Rent on Broadway, I ended up, he has a gospel choir in New York City called the Broadway Inspirational Voices. I helped put together a couple of concerts with him and collaborated with him. We continue to have really good collaborations together. And now I've guest taught here at the University of Michigan often because he called me and he trusts me to come and share my experience with his students. So again, every job I've ever had, every opportunity I can link to somebody I've worked with, every job.
This is so transferable to all of the work that I do. One of the things that I've been saying for many years that is probably the most quoted thing that, from my talks and from my books and so on, is it's not what you know or who you know, but who knows you and what they know, what they say about you when you're not in the room. You know, everything you've said is all about reputation and image and profile. I'm sure that on many occasions, you know, I've taught referrals for many years. Now, the trouble with referral strategy is you have to know the opportunities out there. I'm sure that although you say you audition for many parts, I'm sure that there are times where people have already put your name in the frame before you know the production is already is in the seed of someone's mind. They've already named you as someone they want in that cast because of that relationship and that reputation. One of the challenges that I would envision, particularly if you're working on long film shoots or a long run in a theatre, is staying in touch with people who aren't involved in the project that you're on at the moment. Because you talked about being results focused. It's very much easy to have that transactional mindset where you say, at the moment, I'm focused on this production and I will have the conversations I need around that. And when I move to the next one, I will park this one and go on to that. How do you discipline yourself that even when you're in the heat of something else, just to remind yourself to keep nurturing those relationships that you've had in the past so they continue to remember you when the time is right?
Well, I'm in show business. That means it's not like I get to do a job for 10 years and or 20 years, retire and get a gold watch at the end of the at the end of my tenure, right? So my shows, I mean, the longest run I've ever done is 2 years in a Broadway show when I played Aladdin, right? So that's the longest run I've ever done. And I think constantly when you are going from project to project, job to job, you're constantly always thinking about the next one. So once I land a job, I'm already thinking about the next. I'm already trying to put my feelers out and sort of plant the seeds for the next job. I think what's really difficult for, I think, people in show business, but I think this is also transferable to other businesses, is that like sometimes we don't think of self-promoting what it is that we want. And sometimes we expect the world to read our minds. For me, like, I'm doing a lot of directing these days. People have known me as an actor for the last 20 years. And I was like, well, nobody really knows me as a director. So how am I going to get directing jobs? It is sometimes as simple as saying to all of those people that you've built wonderful relationships with over the 20 years, hey, friends, I'm directing a bit more and I'd like to do it more. Just keep me in mind. It's not aggressive. It's not aggressive at all. There's also no excuse now with social media. You can literally, you know, post a one-line sentence on your Facebook or your or whatever social media network you use and go, hey, friends, I'd really like this opportunity. Can anybody help? And if you've really built that network through the course of a career, people would jump to help you because I think they would want, again, do unto others as you would have done to you. I think others would appreciate that same sort of thoughtfulness and help for you as well, right? When it's your turn to put out the feelers for help. So I think some of that is us thinking of ourselves as little mini businesses, which I know every actor sort of has to do, that I'm a little bit Telly Incorporated. And guess what? Like, Telly Incorporated has to have a publicist that sometimes just puts out into the universe, hey, this is what I'd like to do. And trust that there, you probably have built a network of people that will be like, yes, I'm willing to help. But there's a lot of humility and a lot of ego checking at the door to ask for help and to put those feelers out there, you know, to say, I'd really like to venture into this. You know, it takes a certain amount of overcoming that fear that we are not good enough to meet those opportunities, that fear that we're going to let people down, you know, all of that in order to ask and put that out in the universe. So I understand it's not easy, but it, you know, that's something for you and your analyst to work out, I guess, is to figure out a way to get over that, right? And to put that out there, because the alternative is what? Do we expect the world to read our minds? Do we expect even these people that we've known for a long time in our personal life and our professional life to read our minds when we want something else for our careers, where we want the next step, where we want to maybe switch hats and change roles? You know, no, I wouldn't want a close friend of mine to expect me to read their mind. I would want them to be able to just tell me, you know, and if I can help, I would love to help. It feels good to help. It feels good to be needed. So I would encourage those to out there that are thinking about that, that are thinking about sort of keeping in touch with your network, that your network wants to be kept in touch with. So go ahead and reach out, you know.
Completely. How important is it? How much of a difference does it make if you are working in a production that is in the spotlight? So you're on Broadway, you're in London's West End, you're on Netflix as your current show is. Does that make a big difference to people actually? I mean, this may sound really obvious, but, you know, I want to draw out just where the line is here. You know, people are obviously going to be more aware of you when you're in a Broadway production or a Netflix show compared to something in the backsticks or in a different country that's not, yeah, you know, on the main circuit. And does that influence which jobs you take?
I think, you know, life is short. And I think that became very evident with COVID when the world shut down. And I think we all have a greater sense that, like, oh, right, like at any minute, anything can happen at any minute. A global pandemic can shut the world down for 3 years, right? So I think I am probably choosier about my opportunities, but I think it's more about that. I think it's more about, if I only have 24 hours in a day, how do I want to spend it? You know, and it's not always about taking a job that has the highest paycheck or the biggest notoriety. Sometimes that is a deciding factor, but sometimes I just go, you know, life is short. I've always wanted to do a play with this director. It pays me no money and it's somewhere in the middle of nowhere, but it's a great play. It's a great part. It's with great people. And it's going to be, again, something I can't really put, the experience of that is not something I can put a price tag on. So if I can afford to do that, because I've probably done another job that has made me save some money and put some cash away, yeah, it's worth it for me to go and do that thing, you know? Like, even being here, educational theater, directing at a university is not a huge payday. I'm here to tell you, like, University of Michigan is a very reputable university and a wonderful program that turns out Broadway stars. But as many university teachers will tell you, and guest teachers like me will tell you, we're not doing this for the money. There's obviously something about the time we spend in the classroom with our students that feeds us in a way that I cannot put a price tag on. And I know that when I work with students, I leave, you know, it is hard work. And I am, of course, giving of myself to my students. But I know that at the end of the night, I go back to my hotel room here and I feel more energized. I feel more fed and more inspired because of how my students have inspired me. In some ways, it's wild. I think, gosh, I'm here to teach the students, when in actuality, you know, they give me so much and they teach me so much. They don't even know it, but they do, you know? So the experience of that, I can't put a price tag on, you know, at all. And yes, of course, do I sometimes pick projects and go, right, this is something I have to do because it's an investment in my career, you know, this particular Broadway show that has a very notable role or a TV show. Yes, does that help me, like, get to the next phase of my career? Absolutely. Like, we have to take those things into account. But you also have to take into account those experiences that are for your personal growth. And that also has value, right? Yes, the brand name of a Netflix show or a Disney on Broadway show and the paycheck that comes with that has an actual monetary value or brand name value. But just as important is the value for your own personal growth as an artist, as a human, right? And sometimes those experiences, that is for sure why I'm here with the university students, because, you know, it's not like I'm winning. I told this to my students on day one of rehearsal here. Nobody's winning Tony Awards for the university production of A Little Night Music. Like, so what I'd like to do here with all of you is grow together as artists, because isn't that why we're here at a university? universities for education. It's for growth. So frankly, when I'm here directing a university show, I don't even worry about how good or bad the end result is going to be, because we're here at a university. The purpose is process. So, and it's going to be a good show. I'm not worried about that. But like, that is actually not my main focus. My main focus is, how do you all grow as artists? And how do I grow in turn as an artist by being here? Because this is a university setting.
Well, let's pick up on that, because you very kindly recorded some video for Ruth Gochin and I for the Financial Times Guide to Mentoring. And that video will be coming out in due course. One of the things that struck me in those videos is that you said that you never finish learning as an artist, which is something that you've really just reemphasized now. And then going back to when we met up in London, we were talking about mentoring and you asked me about the difference between mentoring and coaching. And then you threw directing into the mix. And you talk about in the performing arts, you've also got directing as well, which is slightly different. So can we sort of just take those two things together and say, what role have the directors you've worked with had on your growth as an artist? And how do you cope with conflicting advice from different directors? Because, you know, famously, different directors have got different perceptions and perspectives on the world, different approaches to the art, and that's bound to conflict at some time. So how do you process all of that?
Yeah. I came into show business as an actor. I personally connect really well with my directors that have been actors in the past, right? So, you know, when I was in college, Billy Porter was a wonderful director for me. He directed my senior thesis show, basically exactly what I'm doing now for the students at the University of Michigan. It was also a Sondheim musical. It was Company. And I think in many ways, as a student, I needed somebody like Billy, somebody I looked up to, who also graduated from Carnegie Mellon, had a lot of Broadway experience. You know, I, as a senior, wanted to be Billy. Hearing his notes to me, coming from the experience of what it is that I do, of firsthand experience of being an actor, all the insecurities that that entails, also the firsthand experience of being a theater student at that same institution with the same sort of curriculum and training, was so life-changing to me, because an adjustment or a note that he would give me resonated in me in a totally different way, because it was coming from somebody who experienced all of that firsthand. Other phenomenal directors I've had that were also actors, you know, Joe Mantello, who directed Wicked, Neil Patrick Harris, like these are great directors because they also act. So when they give you an acting note, it comes from an experiential place of going, if I was Telly trying to figure out this moment, what is the most useful note for Telly in this moment as an actor? Now that I'm directing actors, I try to do the same. My expertise is in acting, so I try to place myself in their shoes with all of their training and their insecurity and try to give them a note that they would understand. I also am aware that we as actors are different as snowflakes, right? So what one adjustment and one approach to one actor is not going to be the same as the approach to another actor. There are so many different acting methods, acting techniques, all of that filtered through just the fact that we are all different human beings and see the world differently and have different past experiences, right? So when I speak to an actor, I don't have like one way of speaking to an actor at all, because I have to sort of receive what it is that that actor is giving me, understand what that actor's background professionally and personally, and then give them a note that would be effective to them that sort of gets us to what it is that we think the story is for that character. So that's sort of how being an actor and a director has influenced me. I would say that the biggest lesson I've learned in all of my directing duties is that you're not only working with actors. So now I'm collaborating with set designers, lighting designers, the stage management, a dramaturg, you know, all of whom we're all trying to do the same thing, which is put on a show, but everybody speaks a different language. And my fluency for actor talk is not the same as my fluency for set talk. And it's not the same as my fluency for lighting talk, for props talk, right? In directing, I've picked up more languages and I'm more fluent at those languages. But as a director, I feel like it is my job, because I don't know everything and I come from an acting background. It is my job to then go, you know what? I'm going to humbly admit that I don't know everything there is to know about lighting. So I'm going to hire a phenomenal lighting designer and say to that person, I don't know everything about lighting. So I'm going to count on you to tell me what it is that I don't know in a particular moment. I'm just going to create a collaborative space where you can do your best work and that you feel free to tell me what it is that I don't know in any given moment. Again, that takes a certain amount of like humility. I think that certainly takes a certain amount of leadership skill in order to say, this is the kind of leader I am. I'm the kind of leader that I can guide a ship, but I certainly don't know how every part of the ship works, right? I'm not the person, you know, if some part of the ship is broken down at the steam engine, I'm not fixing steam engines down there. Like, I'm going to trust you and let you do that because that is your job, you know? So I think the biggest lesson I've learned, and again, everybody speaks a different language, right? So you sort of have to keep switching languages here and there, and also admitting to people when you go, sorry, say that again, like repeat that, explain that to me again, like I'm five.
So effectively, you're creating a mentoring team of the people you bring onto a production. They're becoming your mentors in the areas that you don't know about.
Yeah, there are so many elements of theater that go into making it, right? Unless you've been doing this for a very long time, you know, unless I was somebody who went from acting to then being a production supervisor to then stage managing, you know, it's too many things, right? So for me, I always feel like, and the more I do this, the more fluent I get in those languages, but, you know, there is going to be a world of things I don't know. But isn't that the beautiful thing about theater? That I can certainly come, I come to rehearsal and I come prepared with how I think the scene is going to look and how it's blocked. Then a lighting designer comes in and goes, wait, Telly, I think I know what you're trying to achieve. If I do the lights like this and this and this, I think that'll give you the moment you want. And because these two artists working separately have come together, we create a third vision of what it is based on that collaboration. That moment, that third vision would not exist without these two people coming together and sharing ideas and thoughts. Isn't that amazing? Again, it's a microcosm for how I would love to see the world, right? Like, I have a very strong worldview. That person B has a very strong worldview. Well, if we sort of hash it out and agree and disagree, we come up with version C, which is actually a wonderful, beautiful compromise and something that would not have existed had two people not come together. Like, that's constantly happening in the theater. And frankly, if that happened more in the world, we'd be a lot better off.
And that's the magic of connected leadership. It's the magic of relationships and really focusing on it and making that happen. Telly, I could chat to you for hours. Before we started recording, I said I'd need to allow a bit more time than normal for this. And we've actually not allowed that much, but where I want to go, I know that it will take a lot longer to answer. I'm going to see you again in London at the end of April. So I don't know if there are tickets left, but do you want to? For those who are in the south of England, do you want to share the show that you're coming over to perform?
Yes, for all my friends in London and in England, I'm going to be at Crazy Cox, which is a wonderful little jazz venue inside the Zedel Brasserie right near Piccadilly Circus. Please come out. It'll be a really fun night. I'm going to be with three of London's finest musicians and a little jazz trio, and we're going to have a good time. So there'll be songs from Broadway, songs from pop, and some really good backstage stories and things and anecdotes. So come out and have fun with us. April 28th.
Fantastic. Well, I'm coming along and I've got a little group of friends coming with me as well. We're all really looking forward to it. I look forward to seeing you then. And I'm really delighted we did this. I'm looking forward to many other conversations. But for the moment, thank you very much for joining me on the Connected Leadership Podcast.
Thank you, Andy. Talk soon.
So I really enjoyed that conversation. I hope you did too. I'm delighted Telly was able to join us. And what I love about conversations like this is when I ask someone to join me on the podcast whose role, whose expertise is seemingly a mile away from the theme of the podcast. But when you talk, it goes right to the heart of it, talking about reputation and influence, talking about keeping the way you treat people, the way you build relationships, the way you engage with people on a production is going to impact your future opportunities. It's exactly the same in any walk of life. And it's so easy to get into that, I'll reach out to people when I need them mode. And yet what Telly demonstrated there that we all need to learn from is that you need to invest in your relationships now, because if you do that, then you're investing in your future. And related to that, he said your network wants to hear from you. So we have to be okay about saying, I need help. I'm looking for this. I'm looking for that. And just checking in as well, so that when we're investing in those relationships, it feels natural when it comes to asking for help as well. lots of great stuff, fascinating conversation. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please share it, please rate and review it. And whatever you do, please join us again next week for another episode of the Connected Leadership Podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Connected Leadership Podcast. If you found this valuable, please subscribe, tell your colleagues and friends, share on social media, and post a review on the podcast channel you use to listen to it. And of course, join us again soon for another interesting interview and great Connected Leadership Tips.